Okay, so I am here with Ken Russell, who is the one and the only Ken Russell. I don't think there's any other ones, who is the man behind such films as Women in Love, The Devils, Mahler, Savage Messiah, Listomania, which is a big favorite of mine, as well as The Music Lovers. Ken, how are you doing?
Not bad.
Uh-huh. That's good to know. No, I don't have Oliver Reed's physique, but I know you did manage to persuade me to do this interview naked. We'll do our best to wrestle during the course of this conversation. I wanted to start at the beginning. In the beginning of your book, Directing Film...
Take your clothes off.
Oh. You described the day of January 5th, 1959, where you had three amateur movies under your belt. You were 35. You had three children under three. And you describe pitching for my very life, a chance to become the greatest director the world has ever known, or remain a mediocre photojournalist who was the laughingstock of Fleet Street. You were set to invade the privacy of Audrey Hepburn, as you describe in the book, on a Swiss airplane, and you decided to deliver a suicide note to your photojournalistic career. So I have to ask you why you placed all of your faith on this meeting with the BBC. Why did you think that you could pitch them and do this and establish a filmmaking career at that particular time?
Well, I had a long interview with Hugh Weldon, who wasn't known for his patience.
Yeah.
So I had to think of how to sort of impress him. And I did that by saying very little. And he asked me a lot of questions, and I did a lot of nodding and humming and hawing and shaking my head. And at the end of it, he said, so you'd like to work for Monitor, that was the name of the TV pro, wouldn't you? And I said, he said, I know what you're trying to say, and it's a very, very big thing I'm asking, you know, and I know you're going to do it, and so there's no need to say too much, because I'll only become annoyed with your sort of answers. And I said, yes, sir, I know you will. And he said, so let's skip that, sir, shall we, and get down to business. Now, why do you want to work for Monitor? And I said, well, it's a prestigious program, and I think it's probably the program that most of all I'd like to work for.
Yeah.
And he'd say, well, that's very interesting. What makes you say that? And I'd say, well, because I'm here with you, Sir Hugh, and I'm busily thinking of the right thing to say, aren't I? Well, I don't know, Russell, are you? I'm finding this rather boring, but I presume you're being... You're trying to keep going and keep the party, keep the flag flying. And I said, yes, sir, that's what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was quiet. I couldn't think of anything else to say.
Yeah.
So I said nothing. And he said, well, that's not very good, is it, Russell? Is this the best you can do? And I said, yes, sir, I'm afraid it is. And he said, well, I have to say you're about the most boring person I've ever come across.
Wow.
And that's all you have to say, is it? Yes, sir, it is. Right, then all I can say is, I'm afraid you've got the job, Russell. Because you're so fucking boring that I can't go on. And I'd say, well, I'm terribly sorry, sir, but that's the best I can do in the circumstances. And he'd say, oh well, you win some, you lose some. I guess I've lost one.
Well, I wanted to ask you about these monitor days and these omnibus television films. I understand that one of the motivating factors in making these was to get the audience's attention after the Sunday television movie. So you have, in the Debussy film, for example, this shocking image of this woman being pelted with arrows and the like. And it seems to me that with that particular method of artistry, of grabbing the audience's attention, that it almost trained you to develop this impulse throughout the course of your entire films. And I wanted to ask if that was kind of always there, or if this was something that just simply working on these films and the exigencies of television permitted you to develop this capacity.
Yes, well, the Debussy film was... what was the Debussy film?
It had Sebastian.
Oh, yes. Well, it had a very tough opening of a girl being filled with arrows. She was female. She was... What was she?
Sebastian. She was a saint. Christian martyr.
Yeah, well, that was the Debussy film, and it was about a Christian martyr.
Which was played by a woman.
It was played by a woman.
Yeah.
Called Sebastian.
Well, you also had Vladek Shabal was in that as well.
Yes.
And he was a big actor who was in all of your early movies. And then maybe... I'm also curious as to how Vladek got involved in your sort of repertory company. He was always a regular. He's there in the boyfriend sitting there, in the audience like that, watching the performance.
Well, he was one of my crew, and I couldn't make anything without him, really.
Yeah.
He was in all my films, practically. And he was very, very good in them too, and I wouldn't have had it any other way, I suppose. He was wonderful.
Yeah. Did you feel that you needed to have a group of people in your films who you could rely on, the regulars and the like, you know, for example, cinematographer Bush and the like, people who you knew would be there for you, that this made filmmaking for you a little easier, a little bit more
confident. Yes.
You were confident in your directorial abilities.
Yes, they were certainly confidence. They made me feel confident,
yeah.
And I felt that I couldn't work without them in many instances, especially people like Vladek.
Yeah, I'm also curious about the shift in your composer biographies from being relatively authentic to history to, once we get to Listomania, it's just completely wild. You've got Nazi imagery, the guitar mowing down the Jews. It's rather astonishing, and it's a rather astonishing departure. And I'm wondering why that change came into place, because is it really doing these great composers, is it giving them the proper respect, or have you never really been concerned with that kind of respect to this music that you grew up listening to and the like?
Well, I enjoyed their music very much, and felt they were big enough to characters to be able to take the...
big treatment.
Yeah, they were big enough to take the big treatment.
They had their fame, they had their fortune, so
yeah,
they could take their knocks and the like.
Yeah.
Do you think that by tampering with the historical record in the inventive manner that you did, that it was almost a way of causing the audience to look at these figures and pay attention to the music, that the music was possibly more important than any gossipy tidbits that were either represented by you or entirely invented by you.
Well, I think that the bits that were invented by me were big enough for the characters concerned to handle.
Yeah.
So I don't think they'd suffer at my enjoyment of making them bigger than they were.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask about the arms stretching out moment. It's in almost every single one of your movies. It's some midway element between, say, your Catholicism and also the fact that you studied for 5 years in ballet. And I'm wondering if this was the compromise point, the aha moment of Roger Daltrey standing at the top of the mountain at the end of Tommy, or the wonderful moment in Savage Messiah in the museum. Why have you been fond of that image, do you think? Is it more sort of a Broadway inspired moment, or possibly something else, or any of these other elements in your life?
I think that it was the just the sheer enjoyment of being able to say fuck you to the to the audience who might have taken exception to it.
Yeah. You felt that the Christ imagery, so to speak, was fair game. I mean, it certainly has been in your films.
Yeah, well, he's character, he can't be ignored, and he means a lot to me, so I have no problem putting him in.
You got into a fight with Alexander Walker, a man who, by the way, you've outlived. Other critics have called your films monstrously indecent. Walker was not the first one. So why did you tap him on the head or beat him on the head with a newspaper? I'm curious. Do you remember what was going on in your mind at the time? Or did you finally have enough of all these critics who were needlessly shitting upon what I think is a remarkable output?
Well, I guess I got tired of him, putting me down. And when he said, you change things... we actually see Oliver Reed's testicles crushed. And I said, excuse me, that's in your mind. We don't see his testicles crushed because they weren't crushed. Only in your dirty little mind, you pig.
Yeah.
And so he took exception to that. And so I hit him over the head with his review.
Yeah.
Which happened to be a tissue of lies from start to finish. Yeah. So that was the reason.
One of the few filmmakers to really get pugilistic about your critics there.
Yeah, well, he shouldn't have said that. I mean, we didn't see his Oliver Reed's testicles crushed. He may have wished we had, but we didn't.
It was really you were sticking up more for Ollie than you were for yourself?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm curious about a couple of things I've heard. One being that Oliver Reed apparently slammed you to the kitchen floor so that you would include the nude wrestling scene in Woman in Love. Not sure if that's true. Wanted to run that by you. There's another rumor going around that Ollie and Keith Moon were so drunk on the set of Tommy that they were improvising their lines. And then there's another one that you guys got kicked out of the resort that you were filming out because of Ollie's behavior. First of all, I wanted to find out if these were true. And second of all, given that this obviously must have been a very difficult working relationship at times, and I know that you didn't work with Ollie again until Prisoner of Honor, and I wanted to ask you sort of about, first of all, are these true? Second, what accounts for the delay between Tommy and Prisoner of Honor?
Well, the delay between... the two films was simply down to the fact of availability.
Yeah.
Oliver Reed was only available at certain times and he wasn't available in Prisoner of Honor. And so that was why I didn't use him before.
You got along really well, you said.
Yeah, I got along with him very well.
He called you Jesus.
He called you Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes, a compliment.
So a little bit tempestuous.
Yes,
then.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you did. He did throw you to the floor. You said that, you know, he convinced you to do the.
Oh yes. Scene. Yes. I wasn't going to do the nude wrestling scene because I couldn't think of a way to do it.
Yeah.
Because nude wrestling was frowned upon in British cinema.
More ways than one.
In more ways than one, yes. And so he finally agreed to do the nude wrestling as long as there was no nude wrestling to be seen.
And how did he convince you to do it in front of the fireplace?
Well, he dropped round to my house for supper and said it could be done. It was very simple to do. And he showed me how easy it was. You just faced each other, put out your hand and shook it and threw each other onto the ground.
Wow. Did he often persuade you to insert scenes along these lines? I'm sure it couldn't have been limited to Women in Love.
No, he was one of his favorite methods of persuasion.
Oh, just throwing you to the kitchen floor?
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't the only time, then.
Oh, no.
No, there was a sword fight.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But you won that one by mistake. You closed your eyes.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, sort of jumping off from this point, I know for the Devils, you had sent the most graphic portions of the script to prospective nuns. And this leads me to wonder if you ever had any difficulty trying to persuade an actor to do some of the crazy things you asked them to do in your movies.
Well, fortunately, the answer is no. I had no trouble at all. Because I'm very good at convincing people. Mm-hmm. That it's worth a go.
Yeah.
And nothing ventured, nothing gained. And there were two scenes in the film where the man playing Grandier, for instance, leapt at the idea of having a go at fighting, and that.
What about the nuns? Did they leap at the idea of rolling around?
They didn't mind.
Huh.
No. They each got a pound for taking their clothes off.
A pound. That's it.
Yes.
Wow. That's a way to keep things under budget.
It was.
Yeah.
Being rather cagey, a lot of nuns, they had no trouble in stripping.
Yeah.
Off. And that's why they did it.
Did some of them have any religious background? Was it a cathartic experience for some of them?
No.
I mean, how many of the nuns did you talk to? Did you have to personally convince them, here's a pound and this will be for a good cause?
More or less, yes. Yeah, yes. That did it.
Yeah.
Yes.
The music, you played music.
Yes.
Oh, you played music to help them out.
I did, and that it got them motivated.
You recall which music it was?
Prokofiev's Fiery Angel.
Oh, okay.
Which was an opera he wrote,
yeah,
of the same subject.
Yeah.
It was just slightly a different approach.
Speaking of music, I was always really curious about this because I have read that when you first heard Tommy that you didn't like it. And then later on, you're making the movie and you're comparing it to Berg. I'm wondering how
comparing
you're...
Comparing
it to who? To Berg? Let me see. Oh yeah, Berg's Wozzeck. And you said specifically it was the best modern opera since Berg's Wozzeck. And so I'm wondering when your mind changed, how it changed, what was the motivation? How did you go from rubbish to best modern opera?
Well, I think it was the best modern opera since Berg's Wozzeck. And I stand by that thought that it was good music. There's no doubt about it.
What set you the wrong way when you first heard it?
I didn't hear enough of it. I only heard fragments.
Yeah.
And when I got to know it better, I realized that I'd done it a disservice. It was actually a good piece of music.
Well, I also wanted to talk about another proclamation you made. I don't believe there's any value in understatement. I would actually disagree with that because your films, in fact, have often featured understatement, particularly the Lawrence adaptations. And I'm wondering if you still believe this. Why isn't there any value in understatement? Why not, if you still believe this?
Well, I don't know as I do.
Yeah.
Believe it.
Well, to also talk about just limits, you know, there's actually a guy by the name of Lester D. Friedman in his book, Fires Were Started, he offered a very spirited defense of your work. He points out, however, that economics and politics, to some degree, with the possible exception of The Devils, which I think is a very political film, are largely absent from your films. I'm wondering why you've devoted so much of your work towards pushing more of the sexual or the violent or the experiential elements or the boundaries of that, while kind of remaining silent a bit, with the exception probably of The Devils and maybe Listomania, on
Mahler.
Yeah, and Mahler, on political ramifications.
Why aren't you political?
Why aren't you as political? Yes.
That's what you always tell me.
Well, Lisa reminded me that art knows no boundaries or borders.
Yeah.
Whereas, I guess that's the reason.
It knows no boundaries, and yet, in not always pursuing politics, it does have some boundaries, I suspect, here, for you. I mean, even if we look at the transformation from The Music Lovers to Listomania, you seem to be pushing further against those boundaries with each particular film. And that's why I asked the question. Maybe you have fenced yourself in to some degree with some of these films, whether it be politically or even artistically.
Are you political?
Well, I think there's a place for politics in a lot of my work, and especially in sort of The Devils, which is a heavily political piece.
Yeah.
So that's the reason.
You got it all out in The Devils, and you didn't really want to mimic that experience? Or?
Well, there'd be no point in... I couldn't better it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was satisfied with what I had.
I've also heard that you turned down offers to do genre movies after Altered States because you didn't want to be pigeonholed. And I'm wondering if that was also one of the reasons why you didn't want to repeat the political experiment of The Devils. You don't want to produce the same film every time.
No, I don't. So therefore, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
In a way, I was tempted, but there'd have been no point.
Yeah.
In going over sort of old ground.
Why are there so many penises in Listomania? I mean, it's a very cock-heavy film, I must say. Very enjoyable, I love it. But probably the most cock-heavy of your output.
Yeah, well, I guess I felt there was a need. There was a need.
Yeah, you need to blow off some things. So. Well, is it possible that, because you were very prolific around that time, you had Tommy and Listomania playing almost roughly around the same time, being made nearly in the same time. Do you think that the rock and roll elements of Tommy pushed you into crazier territory with Listomania, and maybe you were seeing more penises at the time. I don't know.
Well, I thought there was a need to just have fun.
Have fun? Yeah. It's very playful. But did you hold back a little bit with Valentino because of the reception to Listomania? Because people were really... I mean, I went back into archives and some of these critics and reviewers for a film I loved, by the way, were just utterly ruthless about it. And then I'm wondering if that caused you to sort of push back a little bit with Valentino and then Altered States, maybe. I mean, Altered States gets crazy as well.
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think you... I think you just took each subject and were true to it. List was a rock star in your mind.
Yeah.
And Valentino was a different type of
kettle of fish.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think you intentionally held back at any point. And Rainbow is fairly serene.
Yeah.
Mm. I think it's just...
It depends on the project.
Yeah, the project, and the boyfriend is innocent. And
yeah.
So I think you just like to concentrate on each.
Now, with Patty Chayofsky on Altered States, why did you two not get along? I mean, I know that you were given this project after a couple other directors, and you didn't exactly see eye to eye. He's one of the great television writers, Playhouse 90, you name it. I'm wondering why you couldn't figure out a way to, you know, have tea and crumpets together or something. What happened here?
I didn't like crumpets.
No.
We didn't get on because we couldn't agree on I don't know, what are they called?
The story or the narrative?
The dialogue? The hallucination?
The hallucinations, I guess.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He wanted a lot of movement.
Uh-huh.
And horror. And I wanted a more... reasonable approach.
Yeah. So Chayofsky was infringing upon visual territory. That's what sounds to be the cause of the skirmish here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
And did you try to work things out with him to say, hey, Patty, man, I'm the director. I'm controlling the visuals. I'll respect your words, but...
Yeah, well... He didn't want that. He didn't, he had different ideas. Huh. And, they didn't fit in.
Huh. Well, Hugh Grant, I know you didn't get along with either. I'm wondering why some of these people you don't tend to get along with, or they don't tend to get along with you. I had heard that you and Hugh Grant got into a huge fight on Lair.
I don't know who, dreamt that up.
Oh, okay. It's a false rumor. Okay, we can kill it. So you and Hugh were going along just fine on Lair of the White Worm.
Well, I mean, I suppose we had disagreements. I can't remember what they were at the moment, but
yeah.
Apart from the usual petty sort of disagreements, I can't remember any.
Huh. One last question. Do you think that your films, by way of having all of these visual elements and by way of having such a distinct style, were possibly more anarchic in the production than, say, other films?
What would you say?
I would say your films are not chaotic in the production of them at all. That's my experience after 8 films with you.
Yeah.
That it's oddly enough you would expect them to be.
Yeah.
But that's what shocked me the most was that Ken was, he does have this creative chef's throwing in extra things at the last minute. But as far as, you know, everything's on time, on under budget, you're extremely
consistent.
Very Hitchcockian, you would say, in terms of the degree of planning.
And yet he doesn't communicate his plans.
Ah.
And that's what perhaps creates...
Really? Okay. You
know, that creates a feeling of excitement / fear in some of the actors.
Ah, so what's... The problem you've had sometimes over the years is that you've got all these ideas in your head, and you're not always communicating them to your cast and crew.
No.
And so it drives them nuts... And then I see. Yeah.
I noticed that about him. You know, that he, you know, like he would say, this morning we're going to have some unbelievable scene that hadn't been planned, but that he would immediately, when we're going, he would then shift and do something else that was a compromise that we immediately felt nurtured by.
Yeah.
So you have an intuitive way of working, but it is not chaotic. I would not call it chaotic at all. It's the opposite. I was shocked.
Yeah. So you have a really structured game plan. Yeah. But what ends up happening is you come up with more ideas. I see. Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, both of you, Ken and Elise, for taking the time out. It was a pleasure to talk with you. And let's hope we get a few more films too after you. All right. Thank you.
Good.
Since I was a young boy.